When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota BZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Everybody, welcome to Car Stuff. My name is Scott.
And my name is Ben.
Hey, Ben. What's going on?
Not much, man. I have to ask you, have you ever owned a high-performance car?
I guess so. I had my very first car was a Pontiac Trans Am that was from 1978. Mm-hmm. I guess you could call it high-performance in its time. Now when I look back, performance wasn't all that great. For what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I don't know. I hope that, that Chrysler I'm building is going to be awful fast.
Yeah.
And I've had some fast import cars that, you know, I've tuned to be fast.
Sure.
But, no, I've never really had like a Corvette or something like that, or a Ferrari or anything that I would consider ultra high performance. How about you?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I've decided as a personal change in my life to try to avoid saying no and just start saying not yet.
No.
There's okay. Some things I still have to say no to, of
Midlife
course.
Midlife crisis?
Possibly. Maybe. I'm trying to get – I'm actually preempting the midlife crisis. I'm going to go ahead and get it out of the way in my late
20s. You're pretty young, so that's not a very optimistic outlook.
Yeah, well, I'm a go-getter. What can I say? But
40, that's a pretty good run, 40-something.
Yeah. The reason I'm asking about high-performance vehicles is because today we are talking about Jaguar racing history.
Yes, Jaguar. Jaguar.
Jaguar. And one of the things that is fascinating about this is during the racing events that we're going to talk about through this podcast, there are a number of privately owned, sort of souped-up Jaguars mm-hmm. that show up in the races
mm-hmm.
and sometimes racing against the actual
– the factory.
Yeah, sure.
That happens even now. You find that privateer teams take over some of the cars that are successful mm-hmm. and say, I'd like to field that vehicle. And, you know, they have less money typically. Mm-hmm. Not always. Typically they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tough to go against the factory teams because you've got the in-house development, you know, helping that effort along. And you see that even now. But, in the early days of Jaguar racing, you're going to find that, you know, there were privateer teams fielding cars against the factory teams, but the factory teams were so darn successful.
Yes.
Really successful. And, you know, I think maybe we should do just a brief, from the beginning type history, if that's all right with you.
Absolutely.
And, so that people know where Jaguar came from and how long it's been around and, you know, just that. And we'll get into the racing history beginning in, what should I just give it away? 1950s?
Yeah,
1950s. We'll keep it at that and then, you know, kind of let you in on what happened then because that was really the, that was the peak. Mm-hmm. Of Jaguar's racing history, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'll go with you on that. I mean, their first sporting traditions, I guess we would say, mm-hmm. go a little bit pre-war.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know what? We're giving just spoilers left and right. Let's go back to the beginning.
All right, the very beginning. All right, so we've got a guy here. His name is William Lyons.
Or Bill.
Bill, yeah, but you know, you wouldn't call him Bill later in life because he was knighted eventually. So he actually became Sir William Lyons mm-hmm. At some point. And a friend of his, actually a neighbor named William Walmsley. Walmsley? That's it. Walmsley.
Walmsley,
that's
yeah,
probably a better way to say it. And you know, this is now William Lyons was born in 1901, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1922, when he was just 21 years old, he paired up with this guy, his neighbor, again, William, another William, mm-hmm. who was building motorcycle sidecars. It's kind mm-hmm. of like a side business. It was just something that they were doing on the side. And they formed together to – and, of course, you know, William Lyons, he was interested in engineering from the very beginning, had kind of an aptitude for that.
Absolutely.
So they formed together – a company that they called the Swallow Sidecar Company.
And this was in Blackpool, just mm-hmm. for the record. They,
oh, yeah.
they were also these Swallows, as they were called, you can look at them as prototypical Jaguars, you know, because they didn't have the name.
I think so, yeah.
But it was the same – it was the guy making them.
Now, we say Swallow Sidecar, and mm-hmm. they built sidecars, but you got to remember that eventually they came to start making cars.
Yeah.
And that's very important because mm-hmm. that kind of dictates the very early days of Jaguar.
Right. So if you're hunting the first Jaguar, you're looking from about 1927 on, right, when they started using Austin 7 chassis?
Correct. Yeah. And here you go again, Austin 7.
Yeah.
You remember we talked about this? We talked yes. about this with Chapman.
You know, Colin Chapman.
Colin
yep.
Chapman for Lotus. And what was the other one? I'll think of it as we're going here.
It's going to pop up.
Someone else was using mm-hmm. modified Austin 7s. Now, that seems, again, I said it before, I'll say it again, it's the it seems to be the car to kind of tinker with and toy with and make mm-hmm. it your own.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Swallow Sidecar Company now making automobiles. And it wasn't until about 1945 that – actually, it was in early 1945 when Jaguar Cars Limited was formed.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got the official beginning of what we call Jaguar. If you want to trace it back to 22, you can. But 1945 is the beginning of Jaguar.
Of actual Jaguar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can find a car branded as a Jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, we've got a bunch of people along the way that the kind of – this is according to the Jaguar site. You can go to Jaguar USA and get the same information here about the people mm-hmm. kind of behind the development of Jaguar. And quickly, if you don't mind, I'll go through yeah. the list fast.
Absolutely.
They call it the men behind the mark. And there's really six instrumental men in the history of Jaguar. And I'm sure, you know, okay, there's women also. There's also other men that are instrumental mm-hmm. as well. But these are the six that they point out as being kind of standouts in the history. Of course, there's the founder, Sir William Lyons. And there's Norman Dewis, who is the creator of what they call the Jaguar Experience. And his job was to develop how the car feels, what it feels like to drive a Jaguar, and to make every vehicle a part of that Jaguar experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad job, huh?
That's a pretty sweet
job.
Yeah,
it would
actually.
Be pretty sweet job.
That's kind of
yeah.
like that's like kind of like candy tester.
Yeah, exactly. He was he was what? 10 years. He was I'm sorry. He spent 36 years doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he also one other note about this guy. He also helped develop the disc brake with Dunlop. So remember how disc brakes came from
from
Jaguar. This is the guy, Norman Dewis, along with Dunlop, who helped develop a disc brake. And in fact, this guy, you know, right up to the end said that this is his crowning achievement is because it, you know, it's such a safety device that, you know, it's now employed on every vehicle, really.
Sure, yeah.
It's hard to buy a car without disc brakes. I don't know if you could even find one with front drums anymore.
Yeah, you might be able to find, at least in this country, a used car that has drum brakes on one set of tires.
Yeah, maybe the rear.
Yeah, maybe the rear. I had an Oldsmobile that had that, but mm-hmm. you're not going to find all drum brakes.
Well, you go back, yeah. like my Chrysler has all drum brakes.
Yeah.
But that's going way back. You're talking 45 years.
Yeah, that's a deep cut.
That's a long time ago. So now, I mean, recently, if you're, yeah, overall, you're going to find mostly disc brakes. All right. Then there's the, here we go. Here's the guy who really, they call the mastermind behind Jaguar's racing success. What's his name? Lofty England. And you know why they call him Lofty?
Break this down for me. I heard a couple different things. Why?
Because he was 6'5", Ben. He's a big guy. And not what you would expect to cram into a tiny little race car, right?
Right.
A 6'5" gentleman who they called Lofty was an engineer, actually service manager with Jaguar,
mm-hmm.
who kind of masterminded this whole thing of Jaguar racing in the 1950s. And Well, eventually. I mean, if you want to go way down the road, he eventually took over the role as chairman from Lyons when he retired in 1972.
Right. And this guy's full name, of course, Lofty is not his given Christian name. His full name is Frank Raymond Wilton England.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to say Lofty's a pretty cool nickname, but Frank Raymond Wilton is also pretty classy.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, classy, but Lofty's kind of a cool name, especially for a big tall guy like that. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, I could – it's funny because I had heard a couple stories about why he was named Lofty.
I can imagine.
And they seemed speculative, let's put it that way.
Sure. Okay. Well, according to Jaguar, it was because of his height,
mm-hmm.
Which makes perfect sense to me. And you know what? I'm going to mention a couple others here just because – but we want to go back to the racing success. So remember Lofty England, okay?
Right. He's instrumental.
Not a hard name to remember really when you think about
it.
Okay. Let's mention Malcolm Sayer, who was the aerodynamics specialist. And this is huge for Jaguar because, as we'll find out when we talk about racing, aerodynamics were key to Jaguar's success.
Yes.
And he came from the Bristol Airplane Company, which makes sense as well.
Mm-hmm.
He actually developed and shaped the vehicles that Jaguar would eventually use, you know, the streamlining that they used to become victorious in all these world-renowned racing events. I've only got two more, I promise.
Oh, wait, can I do a guess?
Yeah.
Is one of them Walter Hassan?
No.
No? Okay. No. I just want to mention him. He's an experimental departmental engineer.
Oh, okay. Experimental, that's got to be huge during this time because they're forging new ground here because, the 1950s, it was all new to them really.
Mm-hmm.
Company being founded in 45 and then to take on Le Mans so early in the 1950s. Incredible.
Now, Hassan left right around – see, he went to Coventry Climax in 1949. So
okay.
He may have just missed it.
Just missed the opportunity for the racing program.
Kind of like Pete Best and the Beatles.
Yeah, just by that much.
Ouch.
All right. So there's – I've also got William Haynes.
Yes.
Who was an engineer and actually engineered the C-type, D-type, and E-type.
All the hits, all the good ones.
Also developed developed the XK Straight Six during the World War II nighttime fire watches, which were held at the Jaguar plant during World War II. So, they got this skeleton crew of employees and people that kind of hang around and make sure that things are staying buttoned up around there during World War II.
And you thought our job was stressful.
And this is a guy, designing an engine at this time. And in fact, an incredible engine, really.
Mm-hmm.
The straight six that Mr. Haynes designed. And then the last one I've got is Ian Callum, and he is the current design director for Jaguar. And he's currently working on under him, they've designed the XK, the XF, the XJ. So that's the current fella in control of design over there. And like I said, I want to go back to Lofty because Lofty is the one in the 1950s who really brought about Jaguar's racing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'll be honest, Ben, looking back at this, and I'll stop talking in a minute
no
here
worries.
And let you finally get a word.
Oh, sure.
But honestly, their racing history is relatively confined to the 1950s, and then there's a big lag in time there.
Yeah, there's definitely a gap after this. Now, to paraphrase Van Morrison, cast your memory back there. sorry, I couldn't resist. So we'll go back to Bill Haynes and they're checking out Le Mans in 1950.
Okay.
Right? And so in this race – they see three privately owned XK120s competing. Mm-hmm. Now, these cars are their performance added with the fact that no one had really messed with a good aerodynamic shape for a car convinced them that that there were a couple of design improvements they could make, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they saw the opposition in this race and the way that they saw the privately owned Jaguars performing convinced the guys that if they made an aerodynamically shaped body, meaning if they designed the chassis or excuse me, the outer shell to move sort of with the wind and reduce the friction, that they could literally change the racing game. And what's more, if they could do it by 1951, they just might win the race.
See, that's the incredible part.
Yeah.
How do you go about redesigning a vehicle within a year and then competing in one of the top races in the world, really? One of the top endurance races in the world. This is remarkable because, tell them what the record was here?
Because
this is victories at Le Mans. Mm-hmm. They had 5 victories in the 1950s in Jaguar vehicles. The factory teams did.
Mm-hmm.
The C-Type took the victory in 1951. So we're talking first year out, Ben.
Yeah.
And in 1953. And then we'll talk about the D-Type in a moment, but it won in 55, 56, and 57 also.
Nope.
So for the 1950s, Jaguar dominated the endurance car circuit at Le Mans.
Absolutely. No ifs, ands, and buts. We should also point out that they had a little bit less than a year of building, actually, because they had to spend some time persuading Sir William.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was before he was knighted.
Yeah.
So he's
Bill.
I
would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, at the time he's Bill, the engineer.
Yeah. So they had to spend some time persuading him that this was A, doable, and B, worth doing.
Oh, sure.
And in 1951, I'm not taking away from any of the cachet that comes with winning a race the year after you got the idea for the key to winning. There were 3 C-types in the race.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, our guys won. And let's see. I believe that one was driven by Peter Walker and Peter Whitehead.
Okay.
So it's funny because we've got 2 Peters. We've got
Couple Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Some other doubled up on names here pretty soon. I'd make everything more confusing for us.
Mm-hmm. And so two years later, they've got the not only do they finish first, a C-Type finishes first.
In 53.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Thank you. Another C-Type finishes second, and another C-Type finishes fourth.
Amazing.
It's so weird.
Amazing. 1-2-4 finish.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then but as we move on to 1955,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you want to say anything more about the C-Type? Because I've got a couple of quick things here that we can mention is that, you know, there were only 54 of these cars ever built.
Oh, yeah. We should totally mention
that. And this is crazy. A 0-60 time of this vehicle. This is a race car that won Le Mans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how much – I guess 0-60 is important, but I think just durability and top speed are important.
Yeah.
0-60 time – 8 seconds, Ben.
Which is not so impressive now.
No, not now. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, you look back at this and you think like, well, geez, what a dog. But you know what? Honestly, it's a little lightweight car that's mm-hmm. very aerodynamic. The top speed was only 149, which a lot of road cars will do now.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I don't think my Honda won't do that, but Monte Carlo might.
It might
be maxed out at that or electronically limited to that or something close to that.
It'll max out at that. I guess the best way for me to say it without trying to dog my own car is that theoretically it is capable of achieving.
I understood.
That.
You know what? Don't do it. It's dangerous.
The numbers are on the speedometer.
Yeah, I understand. But yeah. It may be limited to that. But anyways, a 0-60 time that's really not all that impressive now, which was probably okay then.
Right.
But top speed was good. This thing was just slick, though. I mean, if you look at a picture of a C-type Jaguar from, you know, 1951, mm-hmm. 52, 53, it's an impressive-looking race car. And go ahead.
Oh, I didn't mean to roll over you there, man. I just also wanted to point out that a lot of historians and race enthusiasts trace the 1953 victories or attribute mm-hmm. those placings to the disc brakes as well.
Really? Oh, yeah. Because they could go longer into the corners.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. Yeah, yeah, so they were able to go a little faster, brake a little later.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of an edge.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, you know what, all makes sense because, you know, every little bit helps and the aerodynamic thing was huge. In fact, so huge that in 1955, they came in with a Jaguar D-Type in the race.
Ah, yes.
And the D-Type, now they built 71 of these. The 0-60 time was greatly improved. It was 4.7 seconds, which is respectable even now. That's very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Top speed was way up. 179 was the top speed. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing about the D-Type, and if you look at it again, take a look online for the D-Type, extremely aerodynamic you know, streamlined design. It was built to be slippery. It was built to be quick. And here's one of the most, maybe one of the most interesting things I got out of this whole article, I think.
What's that?
Because we have an entire article about the D-Type. We have an article about the C-Type and just Jaguar cars in general. The D-Type article mentions that, you know, the engineers realized that, you know, and we talked about the aerodynamicist, I had a hard time with that word, but Malcolm Sayer, he decided that, you know, here's this course that we're trying to win at, this Le Mans course. And we're focused on this. They raced another series too, but – or other circuits. But it is an 8.38-mile course, the one that they were running at the time. I don't know how this has changed over the years. I'll have to dig into that. But at the time, it was an 8.38-mile circuit. So it's a long, long course, and it still is very long. They had something they call the Mulsanne Straight, which is still there. I don't know if it's quite as long as it used to be. At the time, the Mulsanne Straight was 3.5 miles long. So you're talking about a 3.5 mile full out, full throttle, you know, just a shot all the way down, and you can get incredible speed. So you're maxing out, right? That to him said that aerodynamics of a car are critical.
They're key,
Yeah, because if you figure out the percentage of this, that means that the Mulsanne Straight is 48% of the lap of each lap of the race. So that means the other 52%, you know, the other cars that were maybe a little bit faster in the turns, which you were saying that maybe the disc brakes helped. But some of the other cars that were maybe quicker on the acceleration or could go deeper into the turns, they didn't have quite as much advantage as someone who could go 48% of the race full out and still be very efficient. You know, they didn't have to stop for fuel as often if they had a more efficient design.
Right. Slippery, less drag.
Less drag. And, I mean, 3.5 miles of just flat out speed. Man, that's amazing. But, you know, to figure out that it's 48% of the race, in that one straight, that's incredible to think like, well, I just don't know if I would have thought of it that way.
Yeah. There's definitely an objectivity to that that's in its own way innovative.
Yeah, it is. I think it's really cool to sit down and just figure that out. Like, how important is this straight to us?
Right. Yeah. What is the ratio? What is the cost and benefit of modifying the vehicle to perform on this part of the track, even if it may give us some perceived disadvantages on other parts? And that's the, I almost said game they played, but this wasn't a game by any means. Actually, well, before we go on to 1956 and 57, I wanted to mention the difficulties. There were some personal difficulties in 1955 for that race. This race, as we know, there was an enormous accident which caused the death of the numbers that I found are 80 spectators.
Something like that.
And then additionally, the son of Sir William, that was John Lyons, unfortunately had a fatal car accident on the way to the circuit.
Really?
Yeah, on the way to the race.
I didn't know that.
25 years old.
Now, I think it was a Mercedes car that wrecked in 1955, right?
That was in the pit. That wasn't a Jaguar. Good point.
Oh my gosh, it was a you know, you can watch video of that accident. It's horrific. See the car go into the crowd, and it's black and it's older black and white film than I saw, and it's not quite as gory as you might think, but you know, because they stayed away from that, they were not quite like today's media that would jump on the, you know, those shots.
Right.
But it's different. It was covered in a different way, but you can watch it and see and just get a feel for what really was going down at the time.
And that's precisely why I mention it. I know I'm being kind of a downer with it, but one thing we need to keep in mind whenever we talk about these sorts of golden ages of racing is that it seems incredibly glorious and there's so much brilliance among the teams and the engineers, but this is also incredibly dangerous. I would argue that it is much more dangerous back then.
Oh, definitely.
It was much more dangerous back then.
It's still dangerous. You still have driver deaths. You still have accidents that injure crowd, but nothing like what happened in 1955. Nothing like what happened in the Formula One series in the 1960s.
Absolutely.
You know, it's gotten dramatically safer.
Yeah, and it's funny. People can check out our podcast on racing safety, actually.
Yeah, exactly. We've talked about this very recently, as a matter of fact. Yeah. So, there's a lot more information there.
So all you young whippersnappers who are rolling your eyes when we're talking about 8 seconds for 0 to 60, and if you think the numbers aren't high enough or extreme enough, got to tell you, some of the most amazing innovations in racing have been safety-based rather than performance-based.
Correct. Correct. Very good.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, that's no a sidebar.
Not a problem at all. Yeah. You know what? I've got, you know, of course, in 56 and 57, there were other victories for the D type as well. In
right.
Le Mans. And, do you have stats for that, or do you want to just go on to the 1980s?
Just to say the drivers, both years for 57 and 56, that was Ron Flockhart and then, Ninian Sanderson, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly,
beats me.
Was in 56, and then Ivor Boob.
Let's go with Boob.
Boob.
I like the way that sounds.
Ivor
yeah.
Boob in 1957.
Okay.
And the average speed there increased by 10 miles. It was 104 miles per hour in 56, and next year it was 114.
Averaged over 24 hours, that's pretty good.
Yeah, the stakes are rising.
Awful darn fast.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So there was a long gap in racing history because, they just, for a short while, just gave it up.
Yep.
They proved themselves in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. They moved on to making better and I guess more reliable, more efficient, more, you know, better designed, just very stylistic cars.
And moving into a luxurious kind of model.
Just a way to say, a simple way to say it, they just concentrated on the road cars for a long, long time. They concentrated on the road cars, and they came back to Le Mans in 1988. Mm-hmm. And they actually had Le Mans victories. I'm sorry, they came back a little before that, but in 1988 they had another victory.
Yeah, with Jan Lammers.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's Jan.
Jan. Oh, right. Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Look at me.
That's no problem.
Jan Lammers. He came out, I've got a quotation from
driving
him.
Driving a Jaguar.
Jaguar. Jazz, jazz. Okay, so, he said the, Porsche curves, which are, the corners near the end of the lap on Le Mans, he said there were revelation in this era. It's one of the best sections of the track, and I couldn't believe how good the Jaguar was through there. Turning into the right-hander, it's a case of smashing it down a gear or two, dabbing the brakes, then nailing the throttle to the next left. In the Jaguar, you just kept your foot flat. And so it says a lot about the handling.
Oh, it sure does. Yeah, tremendous handling of the car. So in 1988, the reason that they jumped back into this factory backing, because that's the 88 victory was a factory-backed effort. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they did that is because there were so many successes in 1987 in the European sports car series that people were having with, again, privateer teams racing Jaguars.
Oh yeah, we should say that. When we talk about the gap in competition, we're talking about the factory team.
Mm-hmm.
There were privateers throughout that gap.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't like they were completely absent.
Right.
We're talking about factory-backed teams, and 88 is where they came back kind of with a roar here because they had the Le Mans victory, and then in 1990 another victory.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all coming on the heels of, you know, these European sports car races where, again, mm-hmm. highly successful teams and vehicles that had competed in this series. And the factory said, you know what, we need to get back into this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they did.
And they did it with quite a bit of style. These days we might say swagger.
Yeah. And you know what's going on at the time too, and this had to have been utmost distraction. In 1989, if you recall, Ford bought Jaguar. It was late in the year.
Yep.
It cost him about $2.5 billion, but Ford purchased Jaguar in 1989. And it wasn't until about 1999 when they tested the waters a little bit with their Formula One team.
Yeah.
Using the Jaguar as their platform. So by 2000, I mean, we're talking just a year later, Ford renamed what they called the Stewart Grand Prix team for Jackie Stewart.
Yeah.
They renamed it the Jaguar Racing Team. So if, you know, officially Jaguar's back into Formula One in the year 2000. And honestly, Ben, they had 5 seasons in F1. Mm-hmm. Not so good, really. There's stats on, you know, where they finished between the years 2000 through 2004. So they had five seasons. Mm-hmm. Didn't turn out so well. And eventually the Jaguar team was sold to the Red Bull team, Red Bull owner, which is now Red Bull Racing.
Right.
And I don't know. Recently, very little Jaguar racing news has come out. So, you know, with the sale to the Red Bull team, we know that that was the Jaguar team, but it is no longer. And honestly, there's just not a whole lot going on right now for Jaguar and racing. I know there are privateer teams that are all over the place, and, you know, I understand that. But as far as factory-backed teams, they're just not out there.
Which I think is a crying shame, because if I hope that listeners near a computer take some time. If you haven't checked out just some of the beautiful images of these vehicles, please do yourself a favor. It's not even for me. It's for you guys. Because
selfless.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. How altruistic.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you one thing I do love about this job is that as long as I don't overdo it, I do get paid to look at pictures of beautiful cars.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? We've got – I mean, as far as you're mentioning, you know, if you want to check out the cars.
Yeah.
Honestly, go to HowStuffWorks.com, because we've got – I just printed it out here. We've got 9 pages on the C-Type. We've got 9 pages on the D-Type, along with photographs and a detailed history of what's going on. Because you know how we have to skip a lot of the little minutiae that we just can't cover in this podcast.
Yeah.
So it's worthwhile to take a look at both of those articles, the Jaguar C-Type and Jaguar D-Type articles that we have on our site.
And
you know, those link to other – Jaguar interest articles that you might want to check out too.
Yeah, we've got a D-type race breakdown for the winning years we were talking about. Mm-hmm. You can find some pretty cool details on there.
Oh, perfect. And you know what I like to do? I like to take some of that information. And you know, even if it's not there, I like to go somewhere else and find photos of that event maybe.
Yeah.
Like seeing the Jaguar cross the line or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever was happening at that time, I like to go take a look at everything happening around it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a starter point.
God, now I have car envy again.
You know what? I've got one more quick thing that we should mention here, because here's this tie-in. Remember I mentioned in 89 Jaguar was acquired by Ford?
Yes.
It's no longer owned by Ford, and that's relatively recent.
Mm-hmm.
The Ford Motor Company in 2002 – came up with something that they called the Jaguar Land Rover Company. Jaguar Land Rover, JLR. And the reason behind that was they just wanted to manage the businesses of Jaguar and Land Rover, which they had purchased Land Rover from BMW back in the year 2000. Of course, they owned, you know, Jaguar from 1989. So in 2002, they set up this merger where it was just Jaguar Land Rover together. And it seemed easier to control it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jaguar Land Rover later was sold to sold from Ford to, get this, Ben, Tata Motor Company, you know, the Indian company.
Yes, I was wondering if you were going to say that.
In 2008, it's an Indian-owned company now, Tata Motors, who make the Nano, right?
The world's cheapest car that you can buy new, at least.
Sure, most inexpensive.
Okay, you want me to say it that way? That's much more flattering.
That's my corporate line. I got to say it.
No, you're right. Okay, the reason I say that, I don't mean to cast aspersion on the vehicle, but I will, as I said before when we talked about that motor company and that particular vehicle, the thing about the Nano is that below a certain price point, you have to make some very sticky decisions about what kind of safety equipment you're going to include in a vehicle.
Sure, if you're not going to spend the rupees, you're not going to get the the value.
That's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah. That's right. Did I say that right? You're not going to get the quality, maybe.
Yeah.
You spend a few more rupees, you're going to get it.
Yeah, and not that, you know, those cars are changing the world. I'm just saying that if I had a choice, I would save up a little more, and I hope that they're not carrying that same sort of design aesthetic to the Jaguar. Because it would hurt my feelings.
They're going to rebadge a Nano with a they could use the leaping hood ornament.
This is funny to you.
Yeah, it is funny to me because, you know, they've got that leaper hood ornament that they've had, you know, that chrome Jaguar that's on the hood, which is so awesome looking.
Yes.
Can you imagine that on the front of a Nano?
I'm tearing up, man. I'm going to get that single tear going down my cheek. You're playing with my emotions.
All right. I think I'm wrapped up with my stuff here.
Yeah, let's wrap it up while I can still hold it together.
Sure.
But so this is part of the long storied history of the Jaguar. We hope that you found some interesting facts in here. We do hope that you'll check out our website if you'd like to learn more stuff. And do you want to hear about a different car, different racing history? Anything vehicle related, really. You can drop us a line at Facebook or Twitter. You can hit Scott and I up on our website, or you can email us directly at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without finger sticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.